Welcome to Power of the Tribe podcast. I'm your host, John Connors. I'm also the founder and head instructor of Connors Martial Arts here in Norwood, Massachusetts. We teach Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, Muay Thai, kickboxing, and mixed martial arts. And I'm here with my co-host, Dan Robin. How you doing, Dan?
Doing great. How you doing, John?
Very good. Any traveling? I ask you this every time.
No.
No.
Nothing.
Well, we have a great guest today. I'm pretty excited about it.
Yeah.
So people know we get people in here and we interview them about their martial arts career, their take on fighting, maybe they've been bullied, just the whole scope of martial arts and fighting is what I like to do. So the guy we have today is one of our coaches, Dan. He's a brown belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. He's also a mixed martial arts fighter. He's competed in the cage, represented us in the cage. He's a boxer, boxing coach, done some boxing. A lot of boxing, I'd probably say, and just a great guy. And know what I like about him? He takes life seriously. You know what I mean? There's so many people today who are like, don't take yourself so serious. Don't be so serious. And I think people should be taking themselves a little bit more seriously.
That's funny.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And he takes life seriously. So I really appreciate that. And he's a good friend of mine. Mr. Leo Akiki. How you doing, Leo?
Hey, John. How are you, pal?
Very good, buddy.
Thank you for having me. Excited
sure.
to be here.
And the other thing you are is a very successful businessman. So, Dan, Leo does anything to do with cars. If you need auto body work,
that's right.
You need mechanical work. If you need your car washed, he's got a car wash. If you need gasoline for your car. If you need your car towed, he'll tow your car. What else do you do to cars,
Anything
Leo?
Anything automotive, auto repair, auto body.
He's in Hyde Park on Hyde Park Ave.
Near gas stations, car wash.
And that's where I bring my car every time.
It's Akiki Auto, right?
Akiki. A-K-I-K-I. So, Leo, what we usually start with people is, you know, we're fascinated by martial arts and fighting and this type of thing. And the question I try to get from people is, do you remember when you were a young boy, when was the first time the idea of fighting ever came across your desk, so to speak, into your purview? When did you ever think, wow, I didn't know you could just punch people in the face or something like that? Or did somebody ever bully you or anything like that from your early childhood?
My martial arts journey has been long and had a lot of twists and turns to it. Originally, I was turned on to martial arts, obviously, watching like probably a lot of other kids, karate movies.
Right.
I wanted to do karate. Well, I didn't want to do karate. Let me rewind just a little bit more. I did get bullied.
Yeah.
Back in the early 80s, you had the all of the stuff with the terrorism. I'm Lebanese. So a lot of the...
So you got
I've
singled
got a million,
out.
I've got a million stories, you know, like most Lebanese people do, a million stories that we could tell about our lives and families. But that's a good thing about being Lebanese. A bad thing is when you're growing up, the world wasn't as open as it is today. It was more, you know, if something happened in the Middle East, Libya, Lebanon, anything with an L, you know, it was Lebanese. They didn't want to know if you were Muslim or Catholic or whether it was a terrorist act or whatever
it
was.
It all got lumped in as Middle East.
It all got lumped in together.
Now, do you think people today are more savvy about the difference between Lebanon and Libya and these countries?
I'm not sure, John, what it was about that time in life. I think for sure that today the world is a lot more cultured, let's say.
More educated
about
that.
Way. Maybe,
I think so.
Maybe the internet's brought that on.
Right.
I think it's a little better in that people know not to, you know, actually bully someone or beat someone up, but it's still pretty bad. Like I just have a friend who after 9/11, which I guess is not today, like, you know, a ways back, but someone who was like Sikh Indian, but they wore the turban.
Yeah.
And people would like equate them with Middle Eastern or terrorists.
Equate them with the terrorists. Yeah.
Nothing to do with it at all.
That's pretty awful.
How old
were you in the 80s, Leo?
That was, so in 1980, I was 6 years old.
Oh, so you're a little kid.
So from six, right. So from six to let's say 10 or 11, that's when there was some turbulent times in the Middle East. So
in Lebanon, there was Civil War in the 80s?
In the Lebanon, you had a couple of situations. In Iran, for example, you had the embassy that was overrun, and they took the
hostages.
They took the hostages. In Lebanon, you had the Marines, may they rest in peace,
right.
The Marine bombing that took place with Hezbollah. They bombed them. So it was a terrible time, and every time, you know, as a kid, there was no pausing the TV and there was no rewinding. And my dad's English wasn't very good. So I was a translator. So I would translate for my dad every night at 11 o'clock. That's when the news came on. You had Dan Rather on, you know, I'm 6 or 7 years old translating Dan Rather. And I'm translating the news as what's going on in the Middle East. And I'm thinking, oh no, please don't say you did something else. Because now I'm going to get bullied tomorrow at school about it. So I'm translating the news. And at the same time, I'm very, you know, nervous about.
You're gearing up for what's
coming. I've got to deal with the bully across the street and the bully in school. And it was just a minefield walking to school. So that's where the bullying took place, which is different, John. And then today, another thing that's different. Then it was kind of like, I don't know, maybe it was the area I grew up in or the people I was surrounded myself with. But bullying back then was good. It was popular. If there was a bully, he was the tough guy. He was the guy people wanted to be friends with.
Wow. He had social standing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, just let me be in your good graces is what everyone's.
You grew up in Hyde Park?
We was born in Dedham. We were born in Rosendale. I moved to Dedham. I was probably on the Dedham, East Dedham line.
Right.
But I went to the East Dedham schools with all the East Dedham kids, which isn't the, probably the average household income is not on the higher end of the spectrum in East Dedham. So that was the level of social standing that we were going to school with. As opposed to when you go to, I saw this the other day at your academy, actually, and I said, I wish that was around when I was a kid. I think someone had done something to another kid. I had just walked in.
Yeah.
And I saw all the kids kind of rally around and point at the kid and say, he's bullying. He's bullying. Hmm. He's bullying. They were all pointing. And the kid was backpedaling. I didn't bully. Hmm. He was denying that he was bullying. Hmm. So why couldn't I have acted? Yeah,
we had nothing like that.
What is going on here? I thought that was incredible. Huh. Where was that when I was so... You'd find back in the 80s when I'm getting bullied, find your friends are long gone. They're standing with the bully. Yeah. It's like, that's with my friends. Yeah. No, we're with him if you're on the outs.
Yeah,
with him.
They're giving you the wink. They're Leo. We're with you. Don't worry about it. As soon as this guy leaves, I'll be your friend.
So, yeah, that's where we got turned on to martial arts, where I said I had wished or hoped that I could be able to defend myself.
You know, East Dedham, that's where we had our original academy.
I know that. And I'm going to get you there.
Freddie Roach grew up in East Dedham, too.
25 years before you had your academy there. I'm about to get you there.
Yeah.
That was my very first taste of martial arts was Fred Villari's karate.
So, Dan, do you remember we had the space that Fred Villari's used to have? So when the room got all steamed up, you could see on the window it said Fred Villari's studio self-defense.
I never even knew that.
Yeah.
I never even knew it was the same building.
Oh, my God. So that was short-lived. That whole.
How old were you when you went to Fred Villari's?
Probably 9 or 10.
9 or 10.
Maybe 9.
Yeah.
I was really interested in it. But the whole time, you know, my whole life, I've always questioned subconsciously what I'm doing and who's teaching me and how is this going to apply to life.
Right.
Whatever it is. It could be algebra. You know, I'm wondering.
You're a practical guy. What's the practical use?
How is this going to work?
Right.
Where am I going to use this? I hang out with my parents at work and try to help them and translate for them and write estimates. I don't really use algebra or whatever it may be, history. If it's interesting, okay, I understand this is interesting. But other than the things that interest me, why am I learning them? Where am I going to use this? Mm. So I would always apply that to everything I do, even karate. And I remember standing in the position in karate. I'll never forget it. And
With your fist pointing upside down in your armpits.
And you're going, you know.
The twisting
and
punch.
Twisting and yelling. And the guy's jumping around the room to show you his black belt with, you know, 15 stripes. And I'm wondering, where is this going to really apply? How is this going to happen?
That's pretty savvy for a 9 or 10-year-old kid, don't you think, Dan?
Yeah. And it hasn't really changed. You know, those classes are very
similar. Still doing
those. Yeah.
Now, your parents were not born in the United States.
My parents are off the boat. They came here illegally in 1972 as immigrants from Lebanon. But actually, they came, you know, legally. They just never left when they were supposed to. They wanted to, you know, experience the American dream. So they stayed here in 1972. And I was born here in 1974.
And now it's in the 80s. You're at Fred Villari's wondering, why the hell am I standing in this horse dance?
And any time I wanted to ever do an activity, my parents were always, you know, for doing an activity, but it wasn't like they would take me and meet the instructor, interview him, look at the school. My mom would give me a check. I would go down, fill out the application, give the guy the check, make out the amounts. I used to write all, my parents always struggled with their reading and writing, so I would always write out the bills for them or read the bills for them or do whatever. So that was my experience. It's always on your own. My experiences were always on my own. Football,
and baseball, are you the oldest child son, in your family? You're the oldest son.
And I was the first experience they had with that. My older sister, I have an older sister, but she never really wanted to do the things like I wanted to play baseball. I'd go by a field. Mom, I want to play with those kids. She wouldn't even stop. She'd go home and then tell me to run back or ride my bike there. So I'd go to all the games, bike to all the games, walk to all the big games, sign myself up. But let's get back to the martial arts part of it. I'm on my way to Fred Villari's, and I got my bag, and I've got my, I don't know, they call it a gi in it or whatever. And I hop the fence next to my buddy behind the Avery School. I'm going behind there, and my buddy Dave lived over there at the time. And I hear some firecrackers go off. And it startled me, so I was like, you know, I think I might have said, what the hell, or what the F is that? I might have sworn or something. It turned out to be this guy, Chucky, who's the neighborhood or area bully down in East Adam at the time. And he goes, well, you know, what did you say or what did you swear or whatever? I said, you know, he came up to me, big imposing kid, really, you know, overweight, heavy, twice my size.
What did you say? Yeah.
I jumped into my karate stance. But before I could get off any one of those goofy punches, he just picked me up over his head and slammed me on the ground in a pile of leaves and kicked me a few times.
That works. You're like, where do I go to learn this? How do I pick somebody up over my head and throw them in a pile of leaves and kick them?
Kick them a few times. So after I did that, that's what turned my...
You started questioning Fred Villari's systems.
When I picked myself up, got all the leaves out of my clothes and everything, I went back home. I didn't continue on to
Fred. You didn't go to Fred's. Yeah. The moment Dan started questioning his instruction is when one of the black belts was describing about how at school... somebody put their arm behind his back, and he said, yeah, she grabbed my arm and twisted it behind my back. So that's when the light popped off, and Dan's head, he goes, huh, maybe isn't the most effective way to go about things.
But it's also amazing that you realize that as a kid, because kids usually just stand there. Like, that's unique to you that you're analyzing or thinking about it at all, because the kids just sort of do what they're told.
Well, it sounds like your parents gave you a lot of agency pretty quickly, like, go do this, go do that, so which is great, right? So then you do make the decision for yourself, like, this isn't work. Because so many kids are like, well, whatever, I just do whatever the hell my parents tell me to do, right?
Yeah, my parents just come from a different place, I guess, and pushed me a lot to do a lot of
things. So then you got off of Fred Villari.
Yeah.
Okay. And then you were an athlete.
I was shut off for a very long time from martial arts. Continued on with my football and continued with baseball.
And what about just regular fighting? So then you played football, you became athletic, and then if you fought, you would just use your instincts, I imagine.
Use my instincts.
Yeah.
Sometimes just being able to take quite a few punches was critical in fighting, you know. So I didn't have a particular way of doing things. I did end up in a lot of street fights throughout my life and into my early 20s with some good, you know, I had some good success. I just remember one guy really got my number. He actually had my number twice. It was just so fast. I couldn't keep up with him. I couldn't find him. Speed always was an issue.
Yeah.
That's before you have timing, right? So timing may be able to, or analysis or fight IQ. But when you're just going in, you know, head down, swinging.
Blow for blow.
Yeah. The speed may have been the final outcome. That's where it was. I remember we'd go up to the UFC when I was about 17. We'd go to, not UFC, go to Blockbuster and rent the UFC tapes. Yeah. That's the only thing that I struggle with. I wish was different. I'm not much of a person that wishes things were different. But today I feel a lot of times kids will see something and they'll say, I can do that. I can do what I'm seeing. Why don't I'm going to go learn that and do it. I wish that was triggered in me, because the UFC to me at that time, UFC 1, UFC 2, I'd say, who are these people? Where do you even learn that? How do you become this person? I wish I took it that next step and found out how to become that at a young age.
You know, that's interesting, because I think the reason why UFC 1 was so effective and why Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu became popular is Hoist had that look where, you know, he was a boyish looking guy, you know, nice looking, thin, but he looked like, oh, if he can do it, I could probably do it. It looked like he knows some secrets. And if I learn those secrets, I could be really effective too.
But and also, again, there was a lag between being able to even do it. So you could watch that and say, oh, I want to learn that. Yeah. There weren't schools, right?
I mean, there weren't schools.
There were. If you were lucky, you were in a neighborhood where the first one appeared. But you couldn't go. You couldn't learn jiu-jitsu. You couldn't learn.
Don't forget, no internet as well.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
What is it these guys are even doing?
Yeah, right, right.
I remember I was renting this from Blockbuster, you know, and we'd watch it, and it would be rumored that a UFC 2 came out, and then we'd scour the Blockbusters to see who had the UFC 2. I wish I took it to another level and tried to figure out, because it really intrigued me. I wish I'd try to understand or figure out how to.
So that must have been the late 90s, right?
That might have been the early 90s.
I think the UFC 1, the event was 93, I think.
93,
right?
Early 90s, yeah.
You saw the Blockbuster shortly after that.
That's right.
So then what's the next step? Then what happens?
Somebody turned me on to Krav Maga. And from there, my buddy Mike actually said, I've been training with this guy, Sean. He's Sean Burgo, a good friend of mine. He really got me into the martial arts. He brought me along. He said, I've been training with this guy, Krav Maga. It's some good stuff. So I started training with him, do some classes, did some privates, started getting me in shape. Actually, I was smoking at the time. This was...
Smoking cigarettes.
The smoking cigarette. This is now past my 20s, my mid to late 20s, and I was smoking. I had a lot of bad habits at that time. I was successful in business, successful at work, but for some reason, I don't know how I ended up with smoking and going out a lot, having a good time. And Sean, I started working out with him, and he said, I want you to spar with this guy, this other kid. His name was Nate. And we're going to sit just your foot in the block here and your foot in the block here. So we were in squares, and we weren't going to move toe-to-toe. We're just going to do body shots. We're going to go for 3 minutes. We're going to do three-minute rounds. When I was done with the three-minute rounds, I was the color green. I couldn't lift my arms. I couldn't breathe. And I swore to God, I'm never going to smoke it. And that was the day I quit smoking, never smoked again. And it's been those type of things that have constantly changed me through martial arts times like that, moments like that, that you question, what the hell am I doing?
So I thought you were going to say, most people would go, what the hell am I doing with my foot in the square getting punched in the stomach? And I'm going to go have a smoke and never come back.
Right.
That's what most people.
That's my journey in martial arts.
That's the tipping point.
It's the questions I ask myself mid-training. When I've got my legs over my head, my ribs are touching each other, I'm like gasping just for a bit of air. You know, I ask, what are you doing here? Why aren't you at home sitting down eating a Twinkie or something? But at that time, that moment that I'm asking myself that, that's just another conversation you're having with yourself.
Right.
You got to shut that voice off and say, move a little bit, get a little bit more air, just move a little bit, one more time, move that gi. Move your neck, move your head, move your butt, move your hips just a little more, and it's going to get better. You're going to get out of this. You're going to get out of this. You're going to get back on top. And that little moment right there you're having, that's just something that you live throughout your whole day, throughout work, throughout family, throughout everything. It's those moments you just want to give up.
Mm.
That's really been my martial arts journey. Those little questions I ask myself in the most difficult of times. When you're there all by yourself, there's nobody there. Nobody can help you. The clock's still got 4 minutes on it. This guy's, you know, got 100 pounds on you and more skill and more, you know, those questions right there are really what encompass my martial arts career or martial art journey and how I put that towards my life. That's the important thing. So it was that moment that when I was doing body shots with my buddy Nate, I said, I'm not smoking anymore. I'm never going to be tired again. And I've made that my hallmark, my martial arts is my conditioning. You know, I never want to get tired again. If I breathe heavy, I'm disappointed in myself. I don't even like to even breathe heavy.
Well, I can vouch for that. I see Leo. Yeah. He's just going to keep going. And even if there are moments where he is breathing hard and he's sweating a lot and the other guy's breathing hard and sweating, I know sooner or later, the other guy's going to want to go home before Leo wants to go home. So
I can't wait to get to that place. I'm trying to get to that point, especially with these studs, you know. Oh, God, I can't wait till we both get very tired, very sweaty, and it's been an hour worth of training. That's where I'm most comfortable. You want to make yourself.
I like that so much. I heard
comfortable in that place.
This guy, Grant Cardone, who teaches sales or real estate success and everything, he has something. Be known for your work ethic. Like if people think of you and go, that guy works hard, then you're pretty much guaranteeing yourself you're going to be successful.
I like when he said that.
Yeah.
I read that.
So Krav Maga, then what?
Krav Maga, and then he said to me, Sean, Leo, I'm going to turn you on to a guy. I said, I want to fight. I'd like to take on a fight, Sean. What do I do?
Now, when you said fight, what were you thinking? An MMA
mixed
fight?
Martial arts. Yeah. I said, what do I do from here? And he said, I'm going to turn you on to Peter Welch. So Peter Welch's gym has been a big staple in my life as well.
Yeah.
When is this, Leo? When are we talking about now? Is this still the late 90s or we're into the 2000s now?
Now we're in the early 2000s. At the same time as he turned me on to Peter Welch, I drive by a place in Rosendale called Chinese Kickboxing.
Chinese Kickboxing.
And Submission Grappling. And yeah. The sign was beautiful. It had these two fighters and one was getting swept, hip tossed over his side. And I said, I really want to go in there. You got to have some courage to go into these, you know, a martial arts gym, especially if you don't want to go in as a student, right? You want to go in that
it was
I'm
called,
a tough guy.
And it was Paul's place, of course. It was called Chinese Kickboxing, right?
Paul Lefty Rosado, great guy.
It was right in Washington Street, right in the square there.
What a beautiful place. Yeah. Very small garage door type place. It might have been maybe 30 feet by 30 feet, you know, and the students were on top of each other. Let me tell you, I got some of the best training in there.
Nice.
Everybody was, you know, go. Everything was takedowns, stand back up, sparring. It was just incredible training. So I started training there and at Peter's. So I would do my submission grappling there, and then I would go to Peter's and do my conditioning and try to pick up some boxing from there. And that's when I started to want, I said, Paul, I would like to fight. I've been training here and I'm training with you. So that's when I started to take on and prepare for martial arts fight.
Why do you think you wanted to fight then? Was it that you wanted to challenge yourself, or you wanted to make use of your training, or you're just full of anger, or what, you know, what do you think it was?
I just wanted to test myself. I wanted to put myself to the test, you know, test myself against another person, another man's will, my own will. I just wanted to see what I would do.
Right.
It was a challenge to myself, and it was all of it. I wish I'd done it a little differently. I think sometimes people go in there a lot, very prematurely. So I'm just thinking now, the more I train, the more I realize I'm not ready.
Mm.
The less you train, the more you think you're ready.
Mm.
So at the time, I thought I was ready. 6 months. What else do you need? Now I'm thinking, I'd probably advise someone, you know, to take on a few years of training before you get in. And you want to make sure you have a really good coach and friend next to you to advise you on what to take. You can't just go in. It's all about how you get brought along. And
I agree.
Makeups and
I think most people can't get their head around that time frame. Yeah. If you say, yeah, just train consistently for 3 years and then we'll take a look at it. They don't want to hear that. Yeah.
You're running the gym, John. Do you run into that a lot where people come in and say, get me ready for a fight? I want to fight. And you have to try to explain to them that they need a little while?
Yeah.
Is that common?
Yeah, I think it's very common. And then what we try to do is have them spar a little bit in the academy, and if they're getting their lunch handed to them every session, they should start to reevaluate where they are. Some don't. That's the remarkable thing. Some people can every sparring round they lose, and they're like, "I'm ready, coach." I'm like, "Can you win a round in practice first, and then we'll talk about putting you in there against somebody else?"
Funny, right?
But yeah, they should recalibrate from practice, but sometimes they don't. Yeah, they're not realistic. That's the tricky thing, right? We want to have big, exciting goals, but we have to be realistic about where we're standing right now in order to get to those goals.
Yeah. I took on a handful of fights, competed in kickboxing, did well, competed in boxing, did well, competed in mixed martial arts, did relatively well. I probably split it down the middle with mixed martial arts. What would happen would be if it was a stand-up fight or if I got the upper hand, or if the conditioning was the question, I would be able to capitalize on it. But I would get taken down and not be able to get back up. I said, you know what? I'm going to go join a gym and work on my jiu-jitsu game, my grappling game. The more I went to John's, that's when I called John and said, I'd like to come down and sharpen my grappling game up. John said, sure, come on down. I worked out with the guys one time, and I didn't fight again for about 4 years after that. 130-pound guys wiping the floor with me. I'm 205. I said, oh, that's what I mean. The more you find out, I didn't know what I didn't know. And once I started seeing what I didn't know, I said, what am I doing fighting?
Yeah.
Thank God I came out of there alive. So if I could have done it again, I probably would have gone in with a stronger grappling background. grappling is, you know, most of it, especially at an amateur level. That's my opinion.
I think at the local level.
Local level. If you could get, you know, work your way in, keep your hands up, get a good defense, get the guy down to the ground, you're going to clean up on at a local amateur level before you really get tested there. So I probably would have done that a little different. I didn't want to find out, you know, I'd get out of the fight and someone would say, you know, I tell you this all the time. Oh, wow, you are one tough guy. I said, John, I hate when people call me tough. It means it took a considerable amount of punishment. You know, I'd rather someone say, oh, that was a smooth, you know, submission, or that was great footwork, or geez, what movement, what head movement. You know, I don't want to hear, hey, duck.
Or you got out
of there
untouched.
Doesn't hurt to duck every once in a while. Yeah, that would be good. So ultimately, we did end up fighting for John under the Connors flag, and it was good. We took a fight last second, went up there, young, big guy. And he was thinking about, you know, beating up an older guy, and didn't really work out like that. Went just like you thought, you know, just take him down. And he actually tried to give me his back. I didn't let him off the hook. I kept turning him. I wanted to ground and pound him out. So that's how that ended. That was fun. I wish I would have done it a little differently, but it was a fun ride. It's exciting. It's not over. The journey's not over. We still train every day. We train with the guys. We're looking forward to competing in jiu-jitsu.
I think you're getting better all the time still.
Yeah. I always say it. I really don't think I peaked yet. In any facet of my life, I really don't think I peaked. Mentally, physically, spiritually, I haven't peaked. Once I peak or admit that I've peaked, it's probably going to be that doesn't sound like a very exciting or fun life.
Does that drive you, you think? You're always trying to
absolutely.
Move forward?
Absolutely. Always trying to do something better. Always trying to learn. Always making myself uncomfortable. I love being uncomfortable. I love my business being in an uncomfortable state. You know, I feel like growth is uncomfortable. You know, I see other businesses that let the tables wear out, let the seats wear out, let their way of doing things just settle in. And any kind of issue that's outside of whatever they're doing, the way they do it is almost crippling to them. You know,
so even if your business is running along successfully, you still won't rest, is what you're saying. Still say, all right, how do I mix it up?
Is no rest.
Yeah.
There is no rest. Everyone, you know, at work will try to tell me, look at how great everything is. I don't even want to hear about that. I don't want to think about it.
Leo had a good little chestnut. What's the one about waiting? Tell me that one.
Well, anybody at work, I always tell them, they now know, but anytime, so what happened with that report? Oh, I'm waiting for her to send that to me. I said, waiting is never the right answer to any question in life. Use something else. Do something else. Do that thing and then tell me that's what you did. Call her again and see where the report is. Go down there and check on this. Take an action. Waiting takes it out of your hands, right?
I love that.
Takes destiny out of your hands.
I mean, somebody once told me, seldom use always and never, because it's usually not the case. And I'm sure there are some times where waiting probably is the move, but most people are waiting too much. So
Right?
If you make the mistake of doing something, that's probably a better mistake instead of the mistake of not doing something.
Take action, follow up, check up. Maybe, you know, that person might have forgot about it. You're going to just sit and wait because they told you that they'll, you know, when they're going to get around to it. You know, I would follow up the following day or every two. You don't want to be annoying, but you definitely don't want to just sit and wait. I don't want to do that. And if I follow up with the same person and I get the same result, I follow up with someone else, maybe somebody else higher up over him or something like that, that's going to prompt some action to be taken. But waiting, I just don't want to. I haven't really been successful in anything that I waited for. So everything that I've, you know, that we've done has been because I didn't wait, because we kept pushing, constant pressure. In martial arts and in life and in business, it's constant pressure.
You know what it sounds similar to that I've talked with you already about, John, is that the idea of people saying, well, there's nothing I could do, you know, about almost any problem, you know, even being late to something or, you know, just saying, well, there's nothing I could do. I always think it's better. It sounds similar to me where you just never say that, you know, always take some responsibility about something you did or something, you know. It's so easy to just say, what could I do? So it sounds like the same idea of waiting, like, what can I do?
I'm waiting. Same idea. And all right.
Yeah.
Sometimes I spend the entire week not ending the sentence or the conversation with that, because it's hardly ever okay or all right. What you're saying okay to is usually you're going to just accept defeat or all right, I'm going to wait. So a lot of times when it's not okay or all right, I tell them, you know, you're not going to win any fans by doing this, but you're going to say, okay, ma'am, I'm not going to end the conversation by saying okay.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to say all right, because it's neither one of those things. I'm just going to say, I look forward to resolving this issue. Bye. Right.
And like you said,
people will take you the wrong way, but that all right and okay is almost like a comfort. Like we're tricking each other into thinking it's okay, all right. It's not. Let's say we're having a conversation about it's not okay. Well, I'm not going to issue that payment and I'm going to wait 10 days and then I'm going to see if I get it. Then I'll see if I'm going to, you know, reissue a new payment. All right. She's waiting for me to say, all right. None of that's all right. You know, this was supposed to have been paid. It's not paid. You know, if you can't prove that you've paid it, then issue payment immediately. Then it will be okay. So little things like that, I just like, even my conversations, I don't like them very comfortable. I want everyone to know exactly where they stand, including myself when I'm talking to somebody. And you're not going to win any fans by that, but the crystal clarity of where you stand will be good. That people will know when they're talking to you what this is not going to be, you know, this isn't going to be easy. I better give the right answers. I better get the right results.
And there's a lot of value in that. When you make somebody feel a little bit uncomfortable, you have their attention. When everything's comfortable, people just fall asleep.
Oh, my God.
I know it all the time. Yeah. I notice that when I'm coaching, especially this year, I made more of an effort to make people feel a little uncomfortable. And not to be jerk about it, but just so I can heighten their awareness so they pay better attention, so they learn better. I made the mistake years ago of like trying to make people feel comfortable because, oh, they're coming in, they're feeling a little comfortable coming in to an academy, into a martial arts situation. I'm going to try to help them feel comfortable. And I think that's a little misguided. They should feel at least a little uncomfortable because then, you know, they're awake. They're paying attention.
Yeah. Right. They almost go into a blinking standby, I call it. Mm. You know, like the TV when it's blinking, that it's just on standby, you know, or the monitor. You've got to move it. You've got to move the mouse to get the monitor to wake up, right? Those okays and all rights and we'll get back to you or I'll look into it. That's the mouse not moving. You got to shake that mouse, get that monitor to turn. Oh, I'm up. I'm on. I'm on. All right.
Yeah.
This guy wants some action again.
And you've been using the example of people you don't know, but then people you do know well, like coworkers, they're going to know that you're not so quick to say okay and all right, and they're probably going to treat you a little better.
Dead silence.
Yeah.
Dead silence when I ask a question. They know that they don't have the correct answer, so there's just dead silence in the office trying to get a result. Right. Or dead silent in the shop trying to get a result. And that's not because I'm aggressive. Aggressive, not towards them, but I'm aggressive towards wanting to be the best, wanting to be world class, wanting to be the best. And they know that. And the results speak for that. We don't have any of that. You know, I always call that small talk or those kind of words that will make me wait until later. There is no waiting. There's just action. So, right. Yeah, like you said, you're going to get silence.
Yeah, sometimes. Or sorry, I'm late. They know that it's not that easy to just say, hey, sorry, I'm late, and walk past. And they know
we don't want to do that, guys. We don't want to do it. Just let me know you're not going to be here. There is no 5 minutes or 10 minutes. You know, we're all counting on each other. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of that kind of energy that I picked up from martial arts. I put that inside. And the people, there's a lot of people looking for that. And we have, you know, 60 people that work with us. They respond well to that. They enjoy that kind of energy. They enjoy that kind of leadership. You know, they could be anywhere. They say they like being around us and what we're doing because of where we're going and what we expect of ourselves. So
you think people that don't appreciate that sort of energy will gravitate away from your
Absolutely.
Shop?
Oh, of course.
And you see that?
Absolutely. Yeah. If you don't buy in, I get it, but you can't be here. And I always tell we are a train that's moving. You could be on it or you could be under it, but we're moving. We're going. We're going to this destination. You've got to want to be on the train. Absolutely. For sure. I've seen great success in what we do there and the lives that we've impacted with the people that work with us. And I couldn't be happier with the results and the guys that come around us.
Yeah. So what I'm taking from what you're saying is a couple of things. You mentioned a little bit earlier about clarity. Mm. So when you're clear, this is where we're going, this is how we do things, that's great for people because they know where they stand. They know what's up, you know? And like you said, and if it's not for them, they move on, work someplace else or find another environment or whatever the heck it is. But there's a lot of power in that.
One of our toy managers brought up something the other day, John, that is something that I learned just from those kids in your academy from the bullying when they were pointing, saying, he's bullying. We want to harness that and attach that to our culture as far as not doing your job. We want everyone to be pointing at somebody who's taking a shortcut or not doing something the right way or not following the procedure or not going through the process, as in, look at you pointing at them. You're not doing something that you're supposed to be doing. And we want that person you know, to understand they did something wrong. Just like the kid that was bullied. No, 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 no. All right, I'll fall in line. We just want everyone to be able to identify that that is something that's wrong. And that person realizes, wow, if I do something wrong, everybody's watching me.
Yeah, nothing's going to slip by here.
Right.
Yeah.
Like us policing ourselves.
And I assume you're willing to have people point at you, right? If you were doing something.
Believe me when I tell you that no one ever has to. I come down the hardest on myself. That circles back to what John was saying. Oh, you know, take it easy. You're doing great. Someone might say that to me. Oh, you take it easy. You're doing great, or you're doing fine. I am the hardest, you know, on myself. When I let people down, when I've made a mistake, when I let myself down, or I've done something outside of what our systems and protocols are, I'm very disappointed.
Now, let me ask you something, Leo. I think I have an idea of what your answer might be, but I'm curious. What do you do when you just flat out make a mistake in your business? You screwed up something. Do you do something different when the business makes a mistake? And what about when you personally just flat out make a mistake?
I think
how do you handle that?
It's almost the same. Like, give me an example.
Like somebody brings their car in for repair, and for some wacky reason, something went wrong, and somebody did the wrong thing, or they didn't do it the right way.
You fix hundreds of thousands of cars probably over the years. That's exactly going to happen. That's going to happen more than one time. The result is the same as how I take care of it. Just depends on who's responsible for it. You can say, I do things this particular way. Let's say if you have a new driver who's driving a $100,000 truck and he's towing a $100,000 car and he causes some damage to it and it's his first day on the job. You don't treat that the same way as somebody who did that after they've been working with you for 10 or 15 years. I'll always take care of the problem, but how I end up dealing with the person or myself who's
responsible for the source of the problem, is different.
Maybe different, right?
You say you're hard on yourself. When you find that, gee, I didn't do what I wanted to do, I want more from myself in that particular situation. How do you handle that? What do you do for yourself?
Let's just say, for example, I left early a couple of hours last week. I left early to go to a doctor's appointment and I didn't come back and finish. So that's me. Even though I scheduled my time, this is an example, I scheduled my time to be at the end of the day in the middle of the week, not at the end of the day, at the end of the week. I could have come back and done a few more things. How I handled that was I went in extra early the next day and took care of it. But I said to myself the same exact thing that I say to the guys. You could have came in yesterday and did it. In the end, you could have come in early today.
Mm.
You're never going to make up for that. You're going to be behind for the rest of your life. That's exactly what I say to myself. And that's what I say to the guys. And you know what they say? You're right. You know, because we could have trained twice yesterday and I could have trained twice today. I'll miss a workout sometimes. I'll say, you know what? I'll just do two workouts tomorrow. I'll do the two workouts, you know, rather than pat myself on the back, say, I could have done two yesterday and today. I'm never going to make up for this. You know, I finish that with every effort. Every effort that I put out on something, I finish that effort with saying I could have done more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're doing a punch out on the bag for 2 minutes, I will go as much as I can. And I'm thinking, do it. Your life depends on it. Try to get as many punches as you can onto this bag. The second the bell rings, as soon as it's done, I think, I could have done more. I think I could have put in one more punch. You know, I think, what could I have done? And I do that with work. I do that with gym. I do that with family. I try to do that with everything that I do. Mm. Because if you're always thinking I could have done more, you're always trying to do more the next time.
Right.
If you think I did all I could.
You might take your foot off the gas. I think
you
might
have peaked, right? If you did all you could have peaked. You know, that might have been you peaking. You know?
Well, what I'm also hearing from you is just how precious time is, and I've been feeling that a lot myself. I'm like, holy cow! You're never gonna catch. You're never gonna get that back. What you lost yesterday.
It's gone.
Dan, do you feel like that? Like time is running out. That's how I feel.
I don't know about running out.
I feel like it's running out. I'm like. There's a few grains left to go through the hour.
Almost the other end of the driven spectrum of what you're talking about. Like a day that's spent like, I don't feel good today and it's raining and it's like, let's pop on a Netflix show and, you know, and then the day ends. And I think almost anyone can sympathize with feeling terrible about that day. Like, right. or even a weekend yes. where you're like, the weekend ends and you're like, what did I do? I just sat here and then like, you know what I mean? Like I watched some shows on Netflix and then I. Oh, got something to eat, and then I ate again. You know, even I ate unhealthy food.
Kitchen is in the center of the house, isn't it? You got to walk through that to get to any room.
Yeah, and then I had my fourth slice of pizza, and I just like you just threw all that out the window, and then I think you feel terrible. And I always talk to my kids about that, where you can even enjoy the day, but there's a cost later. At least for me, later, because then later you look back and you go, what was that?
That's like, funny you said that. I just told them about that yesterday before I left to work.
Or like a weekend where I think a lot of times, well, the gym's a good example. I know there's guys that go to the gym and think, I can't wait to get there. But for me, a lot of times I feel like I'd rather just sit around, right? Like I'd rather just sit here. Like it's more than go and have someone strangling me or, you know, but then the problem is later, you know, then the day ends. And if you didn't go, that's when the cost is for me. Then you feel like I didn't do anything. You know, I just sat here.
And that's easier to do in those situations because it's just one day and it's like it's not a red letter day or anything. You know what I mean? So, yeah.
And again, it doesn't have to be a gym with someone punching you or strangling you. It can be just working out, for example. I think a lot of people can feel that. You go, I don't want to go running right now. It's cold or it's hot, whatever. And you go, I just want to sit around.
I think maybe that's when specific goals are helpful. You know, we just did that tournament, the Pan No Gi tournament down in New York. We essentially
congratulations
trained.
On that job,
thank you so
way.
Much, Coach.
Congratulations.
We
Coach
had like
brought home the championship in his division. Yeah. So that was impressive. Congrats on that.
Thank you very much. So we had 7 weeks leading up to it, and that answered that question about why am I doing this? You know what I mean? So I did some really hard workouts preparing for that because I had that thing coming up in front. So it was easy for me to say, whatever it is, 4 weeks from now, I may be feeling really shitty right now, but it's going to make me feel better then. And if I skip this, I'm going to just be feeling that bad 4 weeks from now, which is going to be even worse, you know? So having that goal, I think, helps you do all these uncomfortable things.
Such a lifestyle, isn't it? Such a lifestyle. Lay on the couch, like you're saying. I lay on the couch sometimes at the end of a long, long day. I just want to lay there, just like you're saying. I'm human. In 1 hour, am I going to be any better at anything? What can I do? It's such a lifestyle because you have to have these conversations all the time. In 1 hour from now, I'm going to have either watched this ID program, you know, and this guy that was murdered 20 years ago, or I can go actually leave the gym in 1 hour better than I am right now. Mm. Not just better. Like I'm a better person. I know more skills. I'm in better shape. I've left calories have been burnt. Stress has left the body. I'm going to be a better person in 1 hour. What can I do right now in that hour? There's not much you can do in 1 hour to make yourself better. But I found that, yes, in 1 hour, I can go transform myself into a better version of myself. So that gets me off the couch a lot. That gets me off the couch a lot. You got to have these little mind games you play with yourself, or else it's easy to stay on that couch. Yeah. And it gets easier every day.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Are you familiar with David Goggins? He's a ex-Navy SEAL.
Yeah, I actually do.
Yeah. Do you hear of him, Leo?
I have.
He's an interesting guy, super intense. He does like these super marathon, ultra marathon, all this crazy, crazy stuff. And he has a trick where, you know, he's scheduled to go run 21 miles that day, and he just doesn't want to do it, doesn't feel like doing it. So he says, well, we'll just go out and we'll do five. And then when he's out, after he does five, he goes, well, we'll do five more. And then, but he knows he's going to do it to himself, but it somehow works. And I tried that with one of the last workouts I did. I was doing these really intense hill runs, and I had to do six of them. And I told myself, you know what, I'm just going to do four, the hell with it. But I knew I was going to still do six, and it actually worked. So it's like one of these mind games that you're saying.
You have to play those games.
If you're getting into the deep levels of discomfort, you have to, right?
Right. Because it's easy to not do the right thing.
Right. It actually makes sense not to do it.
Oh, it makes sense.
When it's that uncomfortable, right? When it feels that terrible.
And then everyone sort of feels the same way, that once you're at the gym or once you're running, then you're usually fine. You're usually, you know, like it's just the hardest part is before you go. It's when you're on the couch. You know, when you're sitting on the couch, you're sort of like, I do not want to get up.
On your way there.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Essentially.
I try to give myself like bad misdirections. So I ended up getting back home. You know, I'm human as well. People think, you know, you love to do that. If you notice, most of my trash talking is after I'm done working out. Right. I'm leaving the gym or the mat. Oh, I love trail. It was good. We got some. You know, I didn't say that coming into the gym. Right. You know, I'm leaving. That's a good point
because you've obviously, you're very driven and the whole, you know, this whole time you've talked about how driven you are. But it's not that easy, right?
No, for anybody.
No,
you've got to keep pushing yourself, tricking yourself.
Now, do you give yourself specific milestones like in the next 3 months, whether it's business or whatever the hell it is, I want to get this done? Or are you just like, just keep pushing the boulder forward every day?
John, really, when it comes to that, I think probably I should write things down a little bit more, my goals. But my goals are so, you should have short-term goals and long-term goals, right, they say, and mid-term goals. I'm just always trying to do more. And there's almost no, I mean, if you, no school would teach you to do what I do. I don't have any limits or any, you know, I could have lived a pretty good life with doing probably a tenth less than what we do. As far as volume, and employees, and real estate, we could have just lived a comfortable life and just gone somewhere from 8 to 5 every day. But I just want to see, you know, the conversation really started with you, and I told you this all the time. I thank you for it. Was I reached a point where I was comfortable, and I said, John, what do you think? That I'm given this kind of opportunity, and I'm having that kind of opportunity. It seems like it's a lot. You know, I don't want to bite all this off. What if I can't chew it? What if this? What if that? Some of the best philosophy to my life has been added from you on the mats after a good training session. You said, well, I don't think that's really any of your business, what you can and can't do. And I said, what do you mean by that? You said, well, I think you should try to do every single thing you possibly can. And don't worry about what you can and can't do. The universe will let you know that. And that was the most profound moment. The universe will let me know. You took the burden off me. Like, I'm wondering what I can and can't do. That's none of my business. I don't even have to worry about that. Someone else is going to worry about that. And believe me, I'm looking for other people to worry about things. You just freed me up to just, and I went, I might have doubled in size since that conversation. We keep buying more property, buying more trucks, expanding our business, expanding what we offer for business. Our real estate business is, you know, what on the side is what we did with whatever money we make from the automotive field. We buy real estate and rehabilitate that and use that for rental properties. We put families back in homes that have been abandoned. You really just, you know, kind of unleashed me. So to answer your question, I don't really have, my goals are just to do more. I don't set a limit. I don't want to set a line, just what I possibly can do, anything. Let's say, you know, I don't want to say you want to do X by the next month. I don't want to say that, because when I do X, I'm going to say, I wish I had done, I think I could have, I'm going to do X and say, I could have done more. I'd rather say, I want to do as much as I possibly can, beat this month, last year, this month. So let's say this is September. I want to beat last September. And I want to be the most volume ever. So every month, I'm trying to beat the last month. And I'm trying to do the most I've ever done, volume-wise. So I'm trying to beat two things every month. And every month, I think maybe there's been 1 month in my business's life that we didn't beat the year before's. But every month that I don't do the most I've ever done, to me, is a failure. It's not a bad failure. I'm just, and even, you know, even when I did May of last year, we did the most we've ever done. But both months, felt I walked away, you know, like any time else. I think I could have done more. I think there was something else I could have done. So anytime, I don't really set a goal. I just try to do the most I ever can and most I've ever done. And then even when I do that, I think I could have done more. That's just my philosophy. That's my culture. That's the way I like to, that's the way I like to treat myself. I could have done more.
It's very simple, too. So I like that. Yeah.
Whatever you possibly can do. Yeah. So maybe I should set different things up, but just more than you've ever done before. That's always my goal. Yeah.
You're certainly going in the right direction. Yeah. Holy cow.
I'm always trying to do that.
So let me try to summarize. Leo embraces being uncomfortable, the discomfort. We always talk about it. That's where the growth comes, is if you're comfortable, you're not growing. It just doesn't make any sense. Yeah. And if you're uncomfortable, it's probably a sign that you're doing the right thing and you're in the right direction. And although people in our day and age don't like that, right? We have perfect temperature everywhere all the time.
Right.
And then this idea too of like, don't worry about what your limits are. Just go out and do, and your limits will show up sooner or later.
Your limits are going to show up.
Yeah.
And I will accept them. Right. I will never argue with the universe. I will accept them.
I like that.
You know, I will accept when the universe says that's it. But if the universe has given me health, given my family health, given me a mind that I feel is very well suited for business and growth, inspiring people around me and that are with me and around me. I've got to utilize that.
I think that is so good, having this sort of discontent with the status quo, like this isn't good enough, I want more, but also being satisfied with what comes.
I have something for almost everything. I always tell them, they always, when are you going to be happy? Everyone asks me. The girl in the office, well, the numbers will come out. You know, I'm just walking around upset. I could have done more. When are you going to be happy? I told her, this is me extremely happy. This is as happy as I can ever be, and it's very happy. I'm just not satisfied. I'm very happy. I wake up happy. I go to sleep happy. I'm just never satisfied. They mistake that for being unhappy. Not being satisfied is different than not being happy.
That's a good point, because you could argue, you know, you could say, well, but then you're never happy. But you're saying you are happy.
I'm extremely happy. This is what makes me happy. Oh, God.
Yeah.
The battle is what makes me happy. The journey is what's making me happy. I always tell them, I want to die reaching for something, whatever it may be. Just don't let me die sitting in a chair, rocking, waiting to die.
I love that. Die reaching for something.
Whatever it is, a pen, a pencil, just reaching for something more.
Parachute.
Whatever. That may be where I end up, right? Off the plane without a parachute.
Well, Leo, yeah. I want to acknowledge you as a great coach at the Academy and a great friend to me and an inspiration to me. His high standards influence me and make me try to sharpen myself all the time and be the best that I can be. So I love just being around him, having a conversation with him. You know, if I feel like I'm slacking a little bit, I just want to have a brief conversation with them, and I know that'll slap me out of it and realize I got to do more, like he says, and to do as much as we can and see what our limits are.
Thanks for having me, John.
Yeah, thank
always
you,
room for improvement in within my own self, my own family, with my own business. We're always looking to improve. There's millions of areas that we can improve, and everybody can improve. You know, I've always liked to revisit improving and treating people better and taking care of people in our business.
And I just want to tell everyone who's listening, if you have a car, you got to bring it to Leo for whatever you need done. You're just going to get a world-class approach to your car. So you just can't do better than that. And it's right here in Hyde Park. What's the app? Just on Hyde Park
Ave. On Hyde Park Ave. Our central office is 1035 Hyde Park Avenue. Our
Akiki Automotive.
AkikiAuto.com, and it is Akiki Auto on Hyde Park Avenue. Phone number, if you need us, is 617-361-3773.
AKIKI.
That's it,
man. Thank you so much, Leo. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me.
Do you have anything you want to add, Dan?
No, good.
Awesome. So thank you, folks, for listening. And please share this episode. Please subscribe on iTunes and subscribe maybe on YouTube if you could. And just let people know about this podcast. And we'll look forward to talking to you folks next week. Take care.